This is White Collared, the podcast, season one, episode three, Book of Hours. I want to welcome you to this, the third episode of this podcast. As I mentioned in the previous episode, I am recording several episodes in advance, trying to build up a stock of episodes so that we can get off to a good start on this, and I allow myself some time to deal with any issues that can crop up. So just as a reminder, if you have been kind enough to listen to the first couple of episodes and have left a comment somewhere, a review, or sent me an email, I am hopefully already recording episode around five or six and will not be able to acknowledge your comments and reviews and emails until some future episode. But please be certain I am tracking comments, feedback, reviews that you might leave, although I have limited access. Being that I'm based in the U.S., most of my access is going to be to U.S. reviews. I apologize for that. But I will be tracking them and acknowledging them as quickly as I can. But in the meantime, I certainly do appreciate the support. Now, this episode, Book of Hours, first aired on November 6th, 2009. It was written by Tom Garrigus. I'm sorry, Tom. I mispronounced your name, I'm sure. And directed by John T. Kretschmer. A routine stakeout of a known mob hangout by Agents Cruz and Jones goes sideways when Leo Borelli, local Bob Moss, shows up on the scene. It seems someone stole a valuable medieval Bible from Borelli's church. He wants it back, and he asks the FBI to find it and return it to the church. And as Neil's hunt for clues to Kate's disappearance continues, Mozzie examines the empty wine bottle, attempting to find some sort of hidden message. Well, right off the bat, the surveillance of the restaurant being used for bookmaking is busted. And frankly, looking at how they are doing that, you almost have to wonder if they aren't wanting to be seen. They're not being real subtle about it. They're in a van, which I'm sure is highly suspicious and out of place. They're parked right across the street from the restaurant. And it's clear that Burley and his people, Paul Ignazio for one, know exactly what the van is. So were they deliberately being obvious, or are they just incompetent? Either way, one of Burley's men, Paul Ignazio, ends up approaching their van, and he relays the message from Burley that he wants the FBI's help. As Burley tells it, somebody walked into the church in his neighborhood. He says he calls it his church, but it's the church in his neighborhood, and took the Bible. Peter and Hughes aren't certain that he really means what he says. I mean, literally a real Bible. And they question him and ask him, well, okay, so somebody stole your Bible.
Why do you want our help?
I'm a taxpaying citizen.
So? File a police report.
Come on, Burke. You got your guys sitting on me. It's part of the game, I know, but it means that I'm not free to find out who did this.
Yeah, it means you're not free to bust heads until you do.
This Bible, it's not just some book that the Gideons leave on the nightstand. This is five centuries of history from Naples. The saints prayed over this book.
All right, let's get this straight here.
You may go to confession once a week, but the Bureau doesn't forgive sins. We don't work for you.
What do you want?
Shut down your bookmaking operations at Masso's Club.
It's a restaurant. See for yourself anytime. After Thursday. Please. Please help me find my goddamn Bible.
Now, Borelli is an interesting contradiction. Based on what we know about him so far, both from direct and indirect information, we can conclude that he's a mobster who very likely routinely breaks most of the Ten Commandments. He's not the sort of person one would typically expect to have any reverence or respect for God or the church or even a Bible, and yet he seems to have both, and in particular seems to have a lot of respect for this specific Bible. And we know he doesn't have a whole lot of respect, at least for the church and its teachings, because being a mobster, not only does he routinely break the Ten Commandments, so we surmise, but even in his conversation with Peter and Hughes, he breaks the third commandment of not taking God's name in vain while asking Peter to help him recover the Bible. So he's a very He's very much a contradiction because he has a great deal of respect for that Bible because, as he says, the saints prayed over it. And in fact, getting the Bible back is so important to him that he's willing to shut down his bookmaking operations at one of his clubs in order to get the FBI to help recover it. That's how much that Bible means to him personally, even though the church and its teachings don't seem to. Now, at the same time that Hughes, Peter, and Borelli are in conference over the Bible, Neil and Mozzie are contemplating the bottle. It just seems to be an ordinary wine bottle, nothing spectacular about it, but Neil is convinced there's something, some clue, some hint, some secret message on the bottle, or in the bottle, or something to do with the bottle, but he doesn't know what. Mozzie's getting on his nerves by tapping his fingers, but Neil is saved by a phone call from Peter. Well, saved, interrupted, but it does at least stop Mozzie from annoying him. Neil asks Mozzie to take the bottle and study it, do some research on it, run some tests, and Mozzie says he'll take the bottle, run back to his lab and run some tests on it. And of course, Neil says, well, you don't have a lab, you have a storage unit. And Mozzie responds, well, it's just a matter of semantics. You know, you call it a storage unit, I call it a lab. Looking back at the last episode, Threads, we remember that Neil had a friend who provided the venue for the big party where they were trying to catch the ghost, Gavotte. And we don't know who that friend was. It was never stated. But I think I said at that time that I didn't think it was Mozzie because it was not the kind of place you would expect Mozzie to have for somebody who's trying to keep low profile, a guy who's paranoid about the government surveilling him and whoever else he's paranoid of. And this comment here about, well, you don't have a lab, you have a storage unit, would seem to also suggest that Mozzie was not that friend that provided that party venue, because if he was well enough off that he did own that space, or at least have control and access to that space, he would probably have something a little more sophisticated than a storage unit for a lab. I suppose you could argue that that's keeping a low profile, but that would be inconsistent with having that swanky venue from the Threads episode. So again, looking back at Threads, I don't think Mozzie was the one who provided that venue. Peter and Neil go to the church and are looking around, trying to figure out the layout of the church, what kind of situation they're dealing with. They talk to the priest. They notice that there are no surveillance cameras. And Borelli says, quite sincerely, the Lord sees all. So he seems to truly believe that. So again, we're back to this contradiction of character, because he seems to have a lot of respect and faith in God, a lot of respect and faith in the church, a lot of respect for that Bible, and yet he's a gangster that routinely violates the Ten Commandments. It makes you wonder if Borelli truly believes that the Lord sees all and knows who stole the Bible and provides security, so to speak, for the Bible as it's in the church, then how is it that he thinks that the Lord doesn't see his criminal activity and breaking of most, if not all, the commandments? Or if he thinks that it's okay as long as he goes to confession? He's a very contradictory person. Now, of course, Peter suspects that somebody in the parish did it. Borelli says, no, nobody in the parish did it. And of course, as he's speaking to the priest, he recalls, hey, didn't you used to have a soup kitchen here? And the priest says, well, not anymore. And Borelli hides his face. So there's something going on there, but we don't know at this point what is going on between the two of them. After Neil and Peter leave the church, Neil goes back to his department, and he is discussing the theft with Mozzie.
Who steals a Bible?
People steal everything.
Why would we steal one? In theory.
They're rare.
Yeah, it makes them valuable, but not like a Picasso.
Well, it depends what's important to people.
Why this one?
Well, your missing book is famous. It's known as the Healing Bible.
Really? Attribution.
In 1588, the plague passed through Naples. Father Camillus carried the book into disease-stricken ships in the harbor. Not a single person who touched the Bible died.
Good story.
20 years later, A blind girl regained her sight when she rescued the book from a fire. I could give you many more examples.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you could. Look, maybe you don't steal it for the money. Maybe you steal it because you're a true believer.
Now, as Mozzie and Neil are discussing the Bible, first of all, why somebody would steal a Bible, and they don't have a good reason other than it might be valuable, they begin discussing this specific Bible. And like Borelli, Mozzie seems to be enamored with the history of this Bible and its purported supernatural powers. And again, like Borelli, he's not the kind of person that you would expect to be religious or have a lot of faith in things that are religious or have a lot of belief in miracles. But yet, as he's discussing the things that happened purportedly as a result of this particular Bible being carried into disease-stricken ships in harbor, not a single person who touches the Bible dies, or a blind girl regaining her sight. He seems to be genuinely excited by these incidences, or these reported incidences. So, again, like Borelli, he's a contradiction because this is not what you would expect from somebody like Mozzie. But the conversation does at least lead Neil to conclude that maybe they aren't looking at a theft for financial gain, but a theft of belief, because of belief, because somebody believes in the healing power of the Bible. Now, of course, Neil takes this suggestion to Peter, and Peter is skeptical, very skeptical.
In 1918, 30,000 people in New York died from the Spanish flu. No one in this parish even caught a cold.
Nobody in this church caught the flu.
It's true.
Why these guys and not the church down the block? Because of a book? Tough to swallow.
I thought you were Catholic.
Lapsed.
So you don't think some higher power could have saved the congregation?
Oh, I'm more inclined to think they kept the door shut and loaded up on vitamin C.
Maybe God works with what he's got.
And God said, shut thine doors and eat thine oranges?
Why not?
All right, look. When they dug up King Tut, everybody made such a big deal out of the curse of the Pharaoh.
Yeah, 2 dozen people who entered the tomb ended up dead.
Yeah, they probably caught some old bacterial infection. Germs. There's your divine intervention.
God can't use bacteria?
I prefer my miracles with a little more smiting and lightning.
So here we have another interesting contradiction, because Peter, as a lapsed Catholic, granted he's lapsed, but he was apparently raised Catholic. So he was taught the Bible stories, the stories of the miracles of the Old Testament, the stories of the miracles of the New Testament. He was taught the very things that you would expect lead him to at least have some willingness to believe in the possibility of the miracles, and at least believe in the possibility that somebody else would believe in the miracles. But he seems to discount all of this. And that's an interesting flip, because here we've got three of the primary characters in this investigation, and they are totally contradictory from what you would expect. The guy who should believe doesn't. The guys who you would think wouldn't believe do. So Peter and Neil go back to the church. They meet up with the priest and they're talking to him. They discover that Borelli basically was the reason that the soup kitchen was shut down, because he didn't want the homeless hanging out around the church. Now, there could be two different reasons why that would be the case. One would be because it interfered with his criminal activity. And the other could be that he saw that as being a desecration to the church, which he seems to regard as holy, not just the church being the people, but the building itself. I suspect it's probably a combination of both. Certainly, you cannot dismiss the notion that it interfered with his criminal operations. But given what we've seen of him so far, you also can't dismiss the notion that He viewed the homeless being in that church as a form of sacrilege, which, again, is an interesting notion given his profession and his presumed lifestyle. Well, in talking to the priest, they discover that Steve, a homeless man, had been allowed to sleep in the sanctuary that evening. And so they don't necessarily suspect him, but they at least think he might be a lead. They go to find him in the park and talk to him, and he admits that he stole the Bible, not for himself, but for his dog. but that somebody took it from him, and he is very anxious to get it back because his dog Lucy is sick. And he truly believes that if he can get the Bible to Lucy, that some miracle will happen that will heal her. But the upshot of all of it is that somebody else has the Bible because they took it from Steve after promising to use it to help Lucy. So they ask Steve to come back to the bureau and look at some photos to try and identify the person who talked him into stealing the Bible. And it's not going well. He's an ex-military, and he has mental issues as a result of some of his experiences in the Gulf. Lauren's working with him gently, trying to get him to look through just one more book of pictures, and he seems to agree to it, but they're interrupted by Hughes. One of Borelli's people got shot, Paul Ignazio, Borelli's number two, and his nephew. And it just so happens that Hughes has a photo of him, and Steve recognizes the photo as being of the man who persuaded him to take the Bible. Peter, of course, suspects that the shooting has something to do, or could have something to do, with the case of the missing Bible. So they go to the scene of the crime, and things get a little bit interesting here.
25 caliber case, European gauge.
It's a 22 caliber. This is Brooklyn, buddy, not Bavaria.
Ruiz, I see they let you out of your cubicle.
Yeah, this is my show now. Where's your pet convict?
I left him in the car with the windows cracked.
What are you doing at my crime scene?
This tails into my case.
This is mob retaliation. It's my investigation now. You don't believe me, ask Hughes.
Don't start with me.
They've got Ruiz running organized crime. That's unbelievable.
We offer you that bump every year. Every year you turn it down.
This is mob. The Bible's the key to this thing.
What we got here is a dead member of the Borelli family, probably killed by the Moretti's.
All right, fine. Just let me take a look at whatever's on that body.
It's Ruiz's case, and he's not comfortable sharing intel while Caffrey's with you.
Oh, come on.
He's a convicted felon, Peter, and Ruiz isn't the only one with reservations.
Now, Ruiz is a problem, not just because he's trying to shut down Peter's involvement in the investigation, not just because he has an issue with Neil Caffrey, which he clearly does, but because he's incompetent. We see that Peter was the first one at the scene, along with Hughes. Ruiz is nowhere to be seen, and as Peter is sitting there, or kneeling there, looking at the evidence, and he picks up the empty ammo casing and notes that it's a 25 caliber casing, Ruiz walks up. So he has been away from the scene. He has not, as far as we can tell, not looked at anything there, and he promptly says, nope, it's not 25 caliber, it's 22. I'm sorry, but any kind of competent investigator is not going to jump to a predetermined conclusion simply because of their preconceived notions. They're going to look at the evidence. And the evidence is that that is not a 22 caliber casing. It's 25. I'm not a weapons expert. I'm not an ammo expert, but I did do some research on it. And there's not a single 22 caliber casing that I've found any evidence of that matches the design and the size and the dimensions and the configuration of this casing. But I do find a 25 caliber casing that matches it exactly. So Ruiz, right off the get-go, shows that he has no business being in the FBI. How he got into the FBI, much less being the head of organized crime, is beyond belief. It's the kind of thing that makes you wonder who's making the decisions on this sort of thing. Well, apparently Hughes is at least partially responsible for Ruiz being head of the organized crime, because he does say to Peter, we've offered you that. He doesn't say that the bureau has or the agency has. He says we, which indicates that he was at least to some degree involved in the decision to give it to Ruiz. And when Hughes tells Peter that Ruiz is not comfortable sharing intel while Caffrey's there, he also tells him Ruiz isn't the only one with reservations, basically telling Peter that the other agents and Hughes himself don't trust Caffrey. And we did see in the Threads episode, the previous episode, that Hughes was very condescending toward Neil. In the briefing, when they were discussing how to handle the hostage situation involving Tara and Gavotte, Hughes said, "You're not even supposed to be here, Caffrey. You're just going to go get coffee." So Hughes clearly has an issue with Caffrey, even though presumably he had to have signed off on the agreement to bring Caffrey out of prison. It's probably one of those situations where he agreed to it. He saw the value in it. He saw the need for it, but he doesn't like it. And we're seeing evidence of that. Now, after Peter's shut down by Hughes, we start to see some more hints that Peter isn't always the straight-laced, strictly-by-the-book investigator that he comes off as being, or as he portrays himself as being. And as I had mentioned earlier in the pilot episode, he seems to be willing to let other people bend the rules and take advantage of it himself, or at least willing to use loopholes when necessary to get around official orders or official restrictions without having technically violated those orders and restrictions.
We're off the case.
We've been asked to step down.
So what do we do?
I can't do much of anything. Ruiz is not willing to share the case file.
So where's that leave us?
Like I said, I can't do much of anything.
Oh, you know, I'm getting a little chilly. By this water, aren't you? I think I can borrow your jacket. I swear to you, Peter, under no circumstances will I impersonate the FBI.
Now, this is one of those I'm not saying this type things. I'm not implying this type things. I'm just saying something, and if you decide to take it a certain way and do something about it, I've got no control over it type of things. He tells Neil, I can't do much of anything. I can't do much of anything. Take the hint, Neil. I can't do much of anything, but you could do something as long as I don't know about it, as long as I can, you know, have plausible deniability. I can't do anything, but you can. And Peter has to also realize that Neil was very careful with his words when he said, you know, can I borrow your jacket? I swear to you, under no circumstances will I impersonate the FBI. He's doing the same thing to Peter that Peter just got done doing to him. I can't do this. I won't do this. Not saying I won't have somebody else do it, but I won't do this. I won't impersonate the FBI. And that's the other part of Peter. The part of Peter that is willing to take advantage of other people bending the rules. And then, of course, we find out very, very quickly what Neil had in mind for the FBI jacket. It was to give it to Mozzie, have him wear it, and pretend to be an FBI agent and get into the apartment of Paul Ignacio so that he can let Neil in and they can take a look around and see what they can find out. You know, for a guy who has problems with the man, Mozzie certainly doesn't seem to have any issues with impersonating the man. And in fact, he seems to take a great deal of pleasure in putting it over on the man, even if he's the only one who knows that he's scamming them. And I do have to say that Mozzie does a better job of acting casual and not suspicious in this instance than he did in the pilot, where he met Neil outside, you know, and pulled out the cigarette and said, you know, about the filters. I don't use them. I tear them off. But that's just that whole scene. Terrible acting. Here, he's doing a much, much better job. So maybe he's taken some acting classes somewhere along the way. But as a result of Mozzie and Neil breaking into Paul Ignacio's house, getting unauthorized entry into Paul Ignacio's house, the name of Professor Maria Fiametta comes up as someone Ignacio had an appointment with. She's an art historian who writes about the black market, Sicilian grave robbers, Egyptian smugglers, and Serbian mobsters. Peter and Neil go to talk to the professor to feel her out, and she, of course, lies about knowing Paul Ignacio. As a result of that conversation, Peter and Neil decide that Maria is somehow involved in the theft of the Bible and possibly the murder of Paul Ignacio.
You're lying about Paul. I also have trouble buying the fact that an attractive history professor offed a mobster.
No, you don't want me to see the missing inventory, because if I come down there, it's going to be a lot more missing than centerpieces. You got that?
Okay, maybe it's not a complete stretch.
Sorry, it's just my vendor.
No, it's fine. We were just trying to decide if a woman is capable of murder.
Oh, I think so. What's the issue?
I think we're dealing with a shell game. We'll start with Paul, who for some reason reads Maria's book and realizes that the Healing Bible is worth a hell of a lot of cash. But it's also Borelli's pride and joy. He doesn't want to risk Borelli's wrath, so he gets Steve to steal the Bible.
Plausible deniability.
But if it doesn't work, then he lets the homeless guy take the fall. Well, that's evil.
Takes the Bible from Steve, calls Marie to make the deal. Something happens.
Yeah, the deal goes down wrong, or Paul decides he wants both the cash and the book.
Well, whatever it is, Paul ends up dead, the Bible goes missing. Steve never even met Maria.
And our girl walks away clean with a very expensive book.
You know, if she's smart, she's not gonna have that Bible anywhere close to her.
Hell, I've never seen this devious side.
Don't cross me.
Elizabeth's right about the Bible. She won't keep it close.
I've got it. She knew who you were. Neil Caffrey, master forger.
Alleged.
Alleged, whatever. If she's got the book, it links her to the murder. She's going to want to get rid of it. We've got all the usual channels locked down, but if she thinks you might be interested...
Convince her I'm pliable.
We find some street contacts, float it out that old Neil Caffrey is back in business.
Oh, that could take time to reach her, and there's no guarantee.
Why don't you just ask her out?
Could work. Then she'll say yes.
Yes.
I could probably.
Now, there are a couple of things in this scene to make note of. First of all is the fact that Elizabeth knew that Steve was a homeless guy. Now, nowhere in this scene is that specifically mentioned. So, back to my comments from the pilot episode about how Peter uses Elizabeth as a sounding board. He discusses his cases with her. She's intimately familiar with his work on a day-to-day basis. This is another example of that coming through. It's very subtle, but it's there. She already knew about the case because she already knew that Steve was a homeless guy. And then the other part is that when they're discussing the different ways that they might get Professor Fiametta to reveal that she's involved, Elizabeth suggests that Neil just ask her out. And when Peter says, well, do you think she'll go for it? Even before Neil has a chance to answer, Elizabeth says, yep, she'll do it. And it's interesting because I'm wondering if this isn't a bit of some maternal instincts coming out in Elizabeth toward Neil, the counterpart to Peter's paternal feelings toward Neil. They go ahead and go on with the plan. Neil asks the professor out to dinner. She goes. And while Neil and the professor are at dinner, Peter, Lauren, and Jones mount an operation to bug her home.
It's not bad for a college professor, huh?
Yeah, well, she's either a crook or a trust fund baby.
Yeah, maybe it's both.
They usually are.
Nice catch.
And not a bad place to drop a bug either.
Yeah, it's a good coverage. Let's do it. Wow. She's bringing him back here for dessert.
Of course she is.
Are you jealous you ain't getting any of it?
Neil?
No.
I'm perfectly fine with stale ass coffee. I have an event. Thank you.
We good?
Yeah, we're good.
Careful, Lauren. Don't spill that stale ass coffee. It's a bug. I can hear.
Now, Lauren Cruz, let's talk about Lauren Cruz for a second. First of all, Peter brought her into the team in the Threads episode, and she seemed to be a competent investigator under those circumstances. But here, she seems to be careless, I guess is the best word for it. As she's working through the house with Jones, she knocks over a vase simply because she bumped it with her arm because she wasn't paying attention. And then in her conversations with Jones, she makes the comment about the coffee and is kind of surprised when Peter comments about her comment as she's returning to the van because she forgot that it's a bug. I can hear you. So she seems to be a little bit careless here and a contradiction to what we saw in the previous episode. So maybe she has certain skills in certain areas, but not necessarily others and needs to be more well-rounded as an agent. She also seems to have some attraction to Neil. We know that she was flirting with Neil somewhat reluctantly, but still flirting nonetheless with Neil in the Threads episode. She did feel a little bit of sympathy or seemed to. In the briefing where Hughes was so dismissive of Neil, again, that's the briefing where they were discussing the Tara kidnapping and Gavotte's exchange program. And so she seems to have some attraction to Neil, and it's apparently been noticed. And we know that by Jones's comment about, oh, are you jealous? You're not getting any of it. So she's had some attraction to Neil, apparently, at some point. But she seems to be somewhat over it, I guess. And that may be due to what happened at the end of the Threads episode, where Neil tried to take credit for her work, where Neil tried to convince Peter that he was the one who took down Gavotte, when in fact it was actually Lauren. Back at the professor's house, Neil and the professor are discussing, I guess, what their plans are for the rest of the evening. The professor notices the vase that Lauren had knocked over because she didn't get it back in the correct position, and there was a dust ring evident. So the professor knew somebody had been in there. And of course, she's suspicious of Neil. She was always suspicious of Neil, but this has kind of made her more so and put her more on guard. So she tries to trip up Neil, tries to get him to reveal himself, or at least reveal which side of the fence he's playing, whether he's actually working for the FBI or whether he's using the FBI for his own personal purposes, and whether she can trust him or not. And he, of course, apparently senses this, and so he finds the bug, which he knew was probably there, or probably knew was there, dumps it in the glass of wine and ruins it. And, of course, Peter's not entirely thrilled about that, but it happened. And then, of course, he has to excuse it with Hughes by saying, well, you know, equipment failure. But the good news is that despite the equipment failure, or the alleged equipment failure, Peter can assure Hughes that she does have the book, Caffrey says so, and that she will sell it to him for $250,000 wired to a Swiss account. Ruiz is not happy about that plan, and neither is Hughes, but they really don't have a choice at this point, so they decide to set up a dummy account and give Neil the information to make the deal, which means that they can get the book, and it won't really cost them anything because it's all fake money. It doesn't actually exist. It's only on a computer somewhere. Peter tells Neil about the plan, or at least tells him that Hughes agreed to the deal. What he doesn't tell him is that the money isn't real. He lets Neil believe that it actually is real money that he's going to be paying her, somehow set up in a way that they're not going to lose it, but that it's a real account with real money. He comments about how first they were going to be sending him back to prison, but the next day they're going to be giving him $250,000 taxpayer dollars in an offshore account. So he really doesn't seem to know that it's fake. And then he goes even further by saying to Peter, well, I guess that shows how much confidence that they have in you. And Peter responds, well, and how much I have in you. Peter's lying to Neil, and he doesn't really seem to have a whole lot of faith in Neil at this point. Certainly not enough to tell him that the money isn't real.
Hey.
Hey.
Morning. You're up early.
Couldn't sleep. Big day.
I can tell. You're wearing your lucky tie. Hey, did you find the Bible?
Yeah. The professor had it. Neil's gonna buy it back.
You're giving him money? Wow. No wonder. Lucky tie.
No way. We set up a fake wire transfer.
Then what are you worried about?
He has to convince her that he's working us, which means he has to cut his anklet. For real. The book's worth a fortune. He could run with it.
Well, you have a lot more faith in a ratty old tie than you do Neil.
Yeah, well, this ratty old tie's never forged a priceless map of Vinland.
Why is it so hard for you to believe that he'll do the right thing?
Let's just say that's not his first instinct.
And trust isn't yours.
Occupational hazard. I like to know I can count on something.
I know you do. But sometimes you just have to take a leap of faith.
Now, Elizabeth seems to have a lot of faith in Neil. But again, we see here that Peter doesn't seem to have a whole lot of faith in him. And part of that reason may be because he knows more about Neil's background and history than Elizabeth does. Or given that Elizabeth does know so much about Peter's cases, as we've seen, it just could be that he has a more pessimistic view of Neil's background and Neil's tendencies than Elizabeth does. She's definitely a lot more trusting. Peter does make a reference to Neil apparently having forged a priceless map of Vinland. That's Vinland with a V, not Finland with an F. Vinland was an area of coastal North America explored by the Vikings. Leif Erikson reportedly landed there first around the year 1000, nearly five centuries before Christopher Columbus and John Cabot. The name appears in the Vinland Sagas and presumably describes both Newfoundland and the Gulf of St. Lawrence as far as northeastern New Brunswick, where the eponymous grapevines are found. Much of the geographical content of the sagas correspond to the present-day knowledge of transatlantic travel and North America. Now, there was or is something called the Vinland map, and according to ancientorigins.net, it's either a colossal fraud or an artifact of unparalleled value. It's in the vaults at the Yale University and insured for $25 million. The map first appeared in 1957 when a couple of apparently shady characters tried to sell it to the British Museum. Experts determined that the ink that was used on the map was not typical iron gall ink. The map was declared a fake and the museum declined the offer. But if authentic, the map is considered priceless. Apparently, the major problem with the map is that there is no acknowledgement or knowledge that the Vinland associated with the map was a real place with a functioning society on Newfoundland Island. Well, the rendezvous between Neil and the professor goes off, apparently without a hitch. They each pat each other down to make sure nobody is wearing any hidden wires or anything of that sort. Neil cuts the anklet, which, of course, Peter knew was going to happen, but Ruiz did not know was going to happen. And, of course, Ruiz panics. When Neil cuts the anklet, the alarms all go off, and he and the professor hop in her car and take off with Peter, Lauren, and Ruiz in, we won't say hot pursuit, but at least they are following in a supposedly unmarked van that seems suspiciously out of place under the circumstances. The exchange goes off after Neil verifies that, yes, this is the book that they are looking for. She gets her money and then promptly pulls a gun on Neil and says, hey, I want it all. I want the book. I want the money. So give it to me. And she basically makes it clear that she's going to shoot him and kill him. Of course, Neil thinks he's got the upper hand because he took the magazine out of the gun, but being that he is a person who, as he said in the first episode, the pilot, doesn't like guns, he doesn't realize that you can carry one in the chamber, and he didn't take that into account, and she shoots him. Well, shoots at him. He holds the Bible up, and the Bible stops the bullet. Another miracle? Could be. Or it could just be basic science. Peter, Lauren, and Ruiz show up and arrest the professor. And of course, right behind them is Borelli, who just happened to be listening on a police scanner, kind of keeping track of the investigation. And so he's there to collect the Bible. But nobody knows where the Bible is. Neil says, I gave it to some FBI guy. And next we see Mozzie walking off wearing that FBI jacket that Neil borrowed earlier from Peter, with Bible in hand. Peter knows where the Bible's going to end up. And so they head back to the church. Steve is there with Lucy. And Borelli, of course, sees the Bible, and he's not happy. He's not happy with Steve. He's not happy that Steve has his Bible. But he's a softy, and he feels sorry for the dog. He notices there's something wrong with the dog. That gets to him. And he asks Steve, hey, what's wrong with your dog? Steve tells him, and Steve thinks that since he's had the Bible, and he's had the Bible there with Lucy, that Lucy is healed or being healed. But Borelli says, look, you know, I've got a vet. Let's take your dog over to have the vet take a look at her, and we'll see what's going on. We'll get your dog taken care of. Neil's impressed. Peter isn't.
How'd you know?
Okay, I didn't know, but I took a leap of faith that you'd do the right thing.
Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Told you it's a healing Bible.
Oh, here we go. No way. Borelli's a softie for dogs.
Oh, not enough smiting and lightning for you?
That's not a miracle.
It's not a parting of the Red Sea.
Take my miracles where I can get them.
And again, we see that Peter is a skeptic. He doesn't really believe in miracles. Neil has a lot more faith in miracles and the power of God than Peter clearly does, because he says, hey, I'll take my miracles where I can get them. And seems to acknowledge that sometimes what could be considered a miracle is a miracle of timing, a miracle of change of heart, a miracle of simply things coming together at a time in a way that one might not expect them to under normal circumstances. So again, we have another seeming contradiction. Like Mozzie, like Borelli, Neil, a man who you would not consider likely to be a person of faith, seems to have more faith than Peter, raised Catholic, and the person that you would think would have the faith. Well, of course, the case is over. The anklet goes back on, or probably a new one, because Neil did cut the band on it in order to make the deal with the professor work. So they put a new ankle monitor on Neil, and then we see him and Mozzie back at the apartment. Mozzie's taking a nap. Neil is looking at the bottle, trying to figure out what the message is, where the message is, how to figure out what the message is. And as he's sitting there with the bottle next to a candle, the heat from the candle causes a map to appear. Mozzie had missed it. With all his study of the bottle in the lab, in his lab, in the storage unit, he had missed something. Lemon juice. It disappears. It's invisible to the naked eye and only reappears when it's heated. Because remember, Kate loves the classics. Well, that's the end of this episode. I hope you enjoyed it, or enjoyed some of it at least. If you would like to follow the podcast, please subscribe in your podcast player. And you can also visit the website, whitecolloredpc.com. And from there, you can get links to Twitter, email, where you can contact me through those various forms. I will be providing links to various resources that I utilized in researching this episode, and I will also include those in the show notes. Well, thank you for being here, and please be sure to join me for the next episode as I share my thoughts on episode 4, Flip of the Coin. Until then, take care and God bless.